And now, a word from our sponsors.
One of the sections that people really struggle with the most on the DAT is the Perceptual Ability Test, or the PAT.
Luckily, we've partnered with PAT Crusher to help you guys succeed. These guys are legit. In fact, their service has the highest average reported score out of any service at 23, which is more than competitive for every school in the country.
Now, some of you may be taking the DAT for the second time and want to know what you should be doing differently. These guys have a 100% higher score guarantee, so if your score doesn't go up, you get a refund.
We believe in PAT Crusher so much that we're offering 50% off when you use the code PODCAST, all lowercase, on their website, patcrusher.com.
Now from PAT to pathology, let's get this episode started. What's up, everyone? This is your host, Marco.
And this is your host, Clayton.
And you're listening to the...
The...
Pre-Podcast.
It all...
Oh my gosh. That high five right there was actually me clapping my hands because we're doing this virtually for the first time because Clayton is in a car. Clayton, why'd you go to Arkansas?
I went to Arkansas because we needed to go out on the lake and have fun.
So Emily had a doctor's appointment though, right?
She did have a doctor's appointment.
Are you guys having a baby?
We are having six babies. She's having quintuplets.
Is quintuplets even six? Is that right?
I don't really know.
I wasn't a big geometry guy back in school. Pretty sure it's five here. We're getting news reports live that it's five.
It's fine. I was close.
Love it. So, anyways, what's been going on in the pre-dental podcast world here?
We got a new logo. It took us a year to finally get a logo that looks halfway decent, but we finally got that, so that's good.
We'll probably change it here in a couple months, too. It's a sad part.
Yeah, we will. You never know. We're always trying to be better, you know?
So what free stuff do we have going on here?
Oh, man. Big news there. We've actually never given anything away because nobody's ever trusted us enough to do an advertisement for them. So we're actually giving away a PAT subscription course from PAT Crusher. Actually, today I'm going to post that today, so that's exciting.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, with the way dental school is going, I might have to sign up for that and retake the DAT and reapply.
That's right. But yeah, that's exciting. So new logo. We're actually doing giveaways now that we've been promising that we're going to start doing. So that's good.
Phenomenal. So we actually have another interview today, correct? Our second interview.
We do. I'm so excited about it. I wish I could actually be there. That would be better. But
yeah, you're just a cell phone sitting on a desk here.
In Arkansas today.
So anyways, we are sitting here with Dr. Cordell and Dr. Rose Bush. They are two oral pathologists here at LSU School of Dentistry. I don't really know what oral pathology is. Our listeners may not know what it is, but we are here to learn, and we are excited.
You don't know what it is either.
I hope you know what it is by now.
So without further ado, Dr. Cordell and Dr. Rosebush.
Hello.
Welcome to the show here.
Thank you so much.
So our first question here is, for those of us, a.k.a. Clayton, who might not know, what is oral pathology?
Okay, so oral pathology is one of the ADA-recognized specialties in dentistry. So you have to become a dentist first, go to dental school and get your DDS degree, and then it's a three-year postgraduate residency program after dental school to become an oral pathologist. And you want to add anything about what
this is Dr. Cordell talking now, and it's basically the specialty of studying diseases of the head and neck, to put it in kind of plain language. So we look at all the weird lumps and bumps and things that are in the mouth or in the head and neck region that aren't related to cavities and kind of just generic gum disease. So anything that's something else, that's our area of expertise. And we see patients clinically, and we look at tissue under the microscope to give a diagnosis. And technically the specialty is oral and maxillofacial pathology. So hence why it's the head and neck region, the maxillofacial tissues also.
Nice.
Yeah, I just think it's so cool, too. I mean, I have so much respect for y'all because just being in oral pathology and general pathology, just how much stuff y'all know and how many words y'all know, too, just to describe.
We don't do a ton of words back in Arkansas.
We know, like, three. So it's just awesome just learning from y'all and just seeing how much y'all know. It's incredible.
Well, it definitely has its own vocabulary, that's for sure.
Yes.
So, yeah, no, and, you know, another, obviously you guys know this, but another big part of what we do is teaching, but that's not the case for all oral pathologists. It just depends on what kind of job opportunity, you know, becomes available. Some people only look at, you know, tissue under the microscope as oral pathologists. Some people, you know, are at dental schools and do a lot of teaching, and then other people are primarily research focused. So it just depends on the scenario.
So are there any, like, private sector routes for oral pathologists, or are they mainly tied to dental schools, or what does the field look like in that regard?
Well, definitely there are some people who work in private practice. They are much fewer than those of us who work in an academic setting. But people will go out and start a practice where they're seeing patients who have oral pathology needs and then also have a biopsy service and look at tissue under the microscope, just like what we do here at the school. It's a little bit more of a challenge. It's not like you can just go out and start up an oral path practice and get a ton of people coming in the way you can with a dental practice.
Right.
But it certainly works, and a lot of people will practice general dentistry and have an oral pathology service so that they can kind of do both and work things out so that they can survive and make a living. So.
Gotcha. So how did you two become oral pathologists? Excuse me. Like, what brought you here to LSU from the time that you started dental school?
I'll let you start since my story is tied to hers. So I think and this is Molly Rosebush talking, but I'll let Dr. Cordell start because then mine becomes more obvious, like how I got into it. So
I went to dental school at Ohio State, and I went to undergrad at Ohio University, and then I went to dental school at Ohio State, and I stayed on and did my oral path training there. And the way I ended up going into oral path was one of my mentors. I took an elective in the class. I took an elective on the topic while I was in dental school, and I went and observed our head of oral pathology when he was seeing patients. His name is Carl Allen, and he's one of the co-authors of the textbook that we use for your class, which neither of you may be familiar with. It's one of the textbooks that's used, like, all around the country to teach oral path. It's called Oral and Maxillofacial Pathology by Neville Dam, Allen, and Chi. So Dr. Allen, I went and saw patients with him when I was a dental student, and he encouraged me, said that, you know, I was good and thought that I should consider the specialty as, you know, a profession. And it hadn't really, you know, I enjoyed the rotation, but I didn't think I would, you know, ever be going into a specialty. I was fully planning on just practicing general dentistry. So it worked out, and I did the program, and then I taught at the University of Michigan. When I finished dental school, there were three academic, or I'm sorry, when I finished my path residency, there were three academic positions that were open at the time, and one was Michigan, and one was Nebraska, and one was Mississippi. And my family was in Dayton, Ohio, so I didn't really want to go to Nebraska or Mississippi, so I luckily got the job at Michigan, and I taught there for 8 years. And that's where Dr. Rosebush comes into play. And then I moved here in 2010 to join a very senior person in our field. His name was Robert Brannon. And the position had opened up here to work with him, and I'd always wanted to live somewhere warm. And so this was kind of the best of both worlds because I got to live in a warm environment and work with an amazing pathologist. And then sadly, he passed away in 2013, and that's when he passed away in 2012, and then I recruited Dr. Rosebush to come and join me, and then I'll let her tell you her story.
Okay, so my story is I went to dental school at the University of Michigan, and so I was a dental student when Dr. Cordell was a brand new faculty member there, and so I guess, you know, one of the first things that sort of made me think maybe I want to do oral pathology is I actually enjoyed my general pathology course, and most of my classmates didn't at all. Like,
who wouldn't enjoy that class? I can't relate here.
Oh my gosh.
So that was the first sign for me. And then when we got into oral path, and we had Dr. Cordell as our, you know, brand new, like, course director, like, you know, that made me realize even more, like, yeah, I really do have, like, an interest in this. And so, you know, I asked to kind of, you know, look at slides with her and, you know, see patients with her. And so she really mentored me, you know, during dental school, and then, you know, encouraged me to go for the residency. And so I ended up going to the same residency program at Ohio State. And then when I graduated from the program there, there were two positions open at the time, and one was at Tufts in Boston, and the other one was at University of Tennessee in Memphis. And so when my husband and I visited Boston, we pretty much decided we would just feel broke the whole time we were there. So we kind of took, you know, the job offer in Memphis, like, you know, without too much, you know, discussion. And we were there for 5 years, and then, you know, and totally happy, like, wasn't looking to leave, but, you know, an opportunity came up to join Dr. Cordell down here at LSU. And I just, it was one of those moments where I was like, I may never get this chance again to work with her. And so I took it. So I came in the summer of 2013 to join her, and 7 years.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Awesome. Clayton and I can both probably relate. You know, you have a good offer at Memphis, and it's going to be okay there. But then you get a better offer at another Southern school, maybe LSU. You know, because most Arkansas residents go to Memphis because they have so many more spots. So to all our friends listening in from Memphis, sorry you go there.
Nothing negative to say. All good things. I was very happy there. It was a tough decision to leave, you know. So, but it's been great at both places. I feel like they are both, you know, excellent, you know, institutions to learn at.
Right. Yeah. I feel like they got a new dean, I want to say a year or two ago, and they're making some pretty major changes there for the better. So, and I have some friends there currently, and they really like it. But hey, good. We're glad that y'all are here. So, because we definitely have a preference towards LSU.
Glad to be here.
Definitely.
All right, Clayton, what's our next question here?
Yeah, so just, I know y'all have touched on it, but just with, like, residency training and things like that, how long does it take to become an oral pathologist?
And what does the residency look like? What's day-to-day can someone expect?
So the residency is 3 years, and depending on where you do your training, you get a master's degree if you do a master's research thesis project while you're doing your residency, or you get a certificate. You are trained equally well in oral and maxillofacial pathology, regardless of whether you get the master's or the certificate. Some people also will go on and do a PhD in association with their residency program. So rather than doing a master's project, they will be working on a PhD project, and that takes longer. So it can be anywhere from, you know, 4, 5, or 6 years, depending on where you get that specialty program. Like at Harvard, they get a different level of doctorate degree, and it's a 4-year degree typically. Whereas if you get a PhD, that's either 5 or 6 years. And those are more so people who are doing a PhD are more so pursuing the path of research rather than practicing daily as a oral and maxillofacial pathologist. So that's duration wise. And then I'll let Dr. Rosebush talk about what the day-to-day aspects of residency is like.
Yeah, so the day-to-day involves, you know, all of these training programs are going to have a robust biopsy service, where, because when you're training, you know, to become a specialist, you want to be able to see enough, like, quantity and number of cases so that you feel comfortable, you know, once you've completed that program. So that means every day there are a number of biopsy specimens that they arrive, and they have to be what we call grossed, which involves, like, you know, taking out the specimen, and these are all formal and fixed for the most part, like preserved, you know, biopsy specimens, and we measure them and we record their dimensions, and we'll do, like, special, you know, like, sections on them and things. And then when those come back from our laboratory as slides, then, you know, you look at the slides under the microscope every day, and they're being diagnosed and these pathology reports are being signed. So that's always a big part of the daily training of a resident. Also seeing patients. So I think there's sometimes a misconception that we don't see any patients, or we only like work with dead people or something.
Living in a laboratory.
Those are these forensic pathologists that are working with dead people. Everybody else, you know, that does pathology is seeing specimens from live patients. But oral pathology is a little unique in that, you know, a lot of surgical pathologists, so the ones that are at the hospital and, like, you know, getting like breast biopsies and colon, you know, many of those, you know, practitioners, they don't see patients, they're just seeing the specimens, whereas we do some of both. You know, we see some patients by referral through the faculty practice. Like I had, you know, somebody I saw this morning through that route, and then we do consults in the clinic. So anybody, you know, like Dr. Cordell did one of those this morning, or maybe more, I don't know. And so we are on call essentially every day for that. And we have an iPhone that we hot potato back and forth, like a pager for whoever. So like, if I'm tied up teaching, like, you know, like Dr. Cordell's covering the consults and vice versa. And that's more unpredictable. But anyway, so there's, you know, patient care, there's, you know, training, microscopic training, and then we did some teaching as part of our program as kind of an introduction, because so many people end up going into academics, like they want to expose you to getting used to some, you know, teaching. So we would do like lectures here and there, and then the other big component is the 6 months in surgical pathology. So for our program, it was at the beginning of our second year in residency, we spent 6 months at the hospital doing all like non-oral pathology. So all the other, you know, like we did a month in dermatopathology, so skin, you know, pathology, and a month with like, you know, GI, and I guess it probably varied based on like one in like head and neck that involves like larynx, like not just, you know, oral pathology. And then we had to do a month in autopsy actually. So there was some forensic. So there, you know, you have to have enough exposure to these things that, you know, might develop somewhere else in the body and like metastasize to the oral cavity, and to, you know, to kind of have a clue like, okay, this doesn't look like it originated here, you know,
right.
How do we kind of start down the process of figuring out, you know, what this is, so.
And the surgical pathology side of things is done through the medical, typically the medical side. It's not an oral pathologist that's supervising their medical. When Dr. Rosebush says surgical pathology, that's referencing MD-trained pathologists. Mm-hmm. So that's where that rotation comes into play, and being being at a facility that is affiliated with a medical school. Where you can, or at least at a hospital, where you're going to be able to see those additional types of tissues outside of just the head and neck region.
Yeah, and then one more thing to add, if you go to a program that where you're getting a master's degree, then there's a whole thesis and research project and experiment and defense and
also
know.
Called torture.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I was gonna say it sounds busy on top of everything else that you've listed here,
yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah. So.
And I think, you know, as a resident, when we would go into clinic and see patients, if there was ever a time that we weren't sure of something, we always had an attending faculty member on call who would come and help out. It's not like you were left just to try to figure things out on your own. And I did another aspect of teaching. I actually taught a dental hygiene course through a community college when I was a resident. They contacted our program director at the time, Carl Allen, and asked if he would be interested in teaching this. And he was like, no, but I have a resident who I think could do it. And so, you know, I had to come up with a whole course, you know, and create
Wow.
a whole course, which actually ended up being very beneficial, so that when I went to Michigan, I already had some teaching material prepared. And, you know, not every program is at a dental school, so they don't all have that same experience of building that teaching material. And if that's something someone's interested in pursuing, you know, an academic career, that may be something that they consider when they're applying to residency and just where they're going to go and that kind of thing.
it just always blows my mind. I mean, this is our second interview doing it so far, but just hearing, you know, how much we're learning in dental school and then hearing that there's a whole other world
outside of that,
it's almost not like hitting the reset button because you're continuing your education, but wow, it's just mind blowing.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. Like with surgical pathology, I was wondering, I'm glad you clarified that because I was wondering if that was like a fellowship or something after, but so that's like the medical side of, things.
Yeah, okay. Those pathologists go through medical school first, so they have to have an MD, and then they do a residency in you know, and then there's all kinds of like subcategorizations of that. There's hematopathology and you know, lots of little subspecialties there too.
Right, that's awesome.
So something I was interested in is how has technology changed the way that you guys do your job as far as diagnosing different pathologies and just the treatments that you provide, things like that. Like, I just because we're doing all of this through computers and cell phones, and you know, 10, 20 years ago, that wasn't available readily as it is today. So how has technology changed the way that you two do your oral pathology?
I think probably the biggest thing in terms of diagnosing specimens, the amount of different types of special stains that we have available to diagnose what a pathology specimen is, has dramatically increased. And also molecular testing, looking at actual gene mutations that are within tissues, using fluorescence in situ hybridization. And that is not something we do on a regular basis. We'll consult with other experts when we have to do that type of staining or assessment because it's not something that we have at our laboratory that we use. But that has made a big difference in terms of rare tumors, trying to figure out what they are. I think that also you can scan slides now. You can do like whole slide scanning and be able to do virtual microscopy on the computer.
Oh, that's cool.
Which, if you ask a pathologist, we all like the glass better. We like to look at the glass slides.
So why is that?
The quality of the scanned images just isn't as good as the glass slide, and it's not as easy to manipulate it, move it around.
It's much more tedious.
Yes. So changing the objectives, just the view of the tissue is not as nice when it's scanned. And sometimes also the color changes a little bit. And, you know, we're all very finicky about the colors we like our tissue to be under the microscope. So, but we have board cases that we're required to, well, we're not required, but if you want to maintain your diplomat status as a member of the American board, you have to participate in some form of CE. And
that was going to be my next question, is what CE do you have to do after residency?
Yeah, so we have these slides, these review slides that we have to look at, and there's a couple different ways that you can do it. And one option is virtual slides that have been selected and scanned by the organization, and we have to review like a little history and then come up with a diagnosis based on the scanned slides. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty dramatic change.
Yeah.
And then the teaching.
Well, yeah. So you would ask specifically about like diagnosing things. And I think, you know, another thing that has changed a lot is just the ability to send photos, like clinical photos and radiographs. You know, it's just so much easier now, you know, for a clinician to like take a picture with their iPhone and send it to us. And then, you know, I think there's a misconception that we can look under the microscope and it's just totally obvious what's going on all the time. You know, sometimes that's the case, but there are so many situations in which the clinical or the radiographic features are like absolutely essential to correlate with the microscopic view of the specimen. And so just being able to more easily like obtain those from people, I think has, you know, been great.
Absolutely.
And then, yeah, I would say the biggest way in which technology, not that it's new, but that has, you know, changed how we've been doing our jobs as educators are obviously, you know, the way we're delivering content to you guys now because of COVID. I mean, that's been a huge, and it was just, one day you're doing it this way, and then the next day, you know, do it virtually. So, yeah.
And you asked about CE, so we do have a requirement to have a certain number of hours, just like for dentistry, to maintain your license, certain number of hours every couple of years, and maintaining your board licensure has to do with completing these case reviews, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you go through the effort and, you know, successfully pass the board exam, you know, you're going to do what you have to maintain it. And then, actually, do you have a time limited?
No.
Okay. So this is the other, like, thing. So in the few years that, you know, kind of were between when Dr. Cordell, you know, finished her program, took her board exam, and when I, you know, did, they, the board, made the certificates time limited. So every 10 years, I have to take a recertification exam. Whereas that's not like, doesn't apply to her, but they're, you know, they're not as hard as the original one that's like, was this 2 days, like, you know, really.
Oh gosh.
It's basically designed to, if you're a practicing oral pathologist and you're keeping up with, you know, the content, like, you know, it's, you know, you should be successful to, you know, at the recertification.
And a lot of people with the time limited certificates go through the process anyway, just to say that you've done it. And a lot of professional organizations like this are kind of doing away with the time limited certificates again. So many of them went to this, and then some of them are now going away from it, like oral and maxillofacial surgery is doing away with their time limited certificates or the way that they're assessing it. Because they were finding that absolutely everybody was passing the recertification test. So the question was it really a valid test, or
right.
Is it better to have a greater requirement for CE and make people do more in terms of maintaining their status than taking a test that wasn't really a measure of someone's capability per se? Mm-hmm. So I think that may change as well in the future for our specialty.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, so we touched on teaching there. So I guess I would ask, what challenges have you two faced with going virtual? Because I know it's been a challenge for us. I was actually going to show you this photo. So if you remember, General Pathology Test 2.
Oh, yeah.
So this was me after the test. I had a breakdown and I shaved my head.
Oh, no. That's Jeez. Terrible. Oh, no. Oh. Oh. That was literally right after the test?
It was like the next day, yeah.
Oh, my. For those of you that can't see, it was shocking.
We'll post it on social media for sure.
Yeah, we'll definitely put it up there.
I thought I was going to have to wear a Kevlar vest for a while. certainly the lecture component has been drastically changed too, but you know, and we would give anything to have you guys in person.
Yes.
You know? I mean, it's so hard with the Zoom to know, like, is anybody paying attention? Like, you know, and it's just...
Or are you getting it?
Yeah.
Like, do you look like you're, like, understanding it? Or are you totally zoned out? Or are you, like, confused look on your face where I can say, is this not making sense? You know, we can't do that with Zoom because we can't have you all have your cameras on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I would say that the testing has been an even more difficult challenge to deal with, because we are, you know, we prefer to give written tests, and we like to use a combination of, you know, multiple choice and short answer, and the short answers are where people usually do the best because you can get partial credit.
Right.
And so when that happened, the infamous test that Mark was referring to, so they had the first exam in general pathology on paper in our traditional format. And then when we had to kind of give it on short notice as an electronic exam, it's impossible to grade a whole ton of short answer. Like when you have it that way because their questions are all shuffled. So like your number four might be someone else's 80, and for consistency, or not 80, I don't think, I'm not that terrible.
I was going to say
18. But for consistency, we like to grade like the same, everyone's same question. And there was just no method to do that. And then when you make an entirely multiple choice exam, it's just, I don't know. It was, I clearly didn't intend for it to be that difficult, but yeah, I think they were all demoralized for a while. So.
Yeah. It's an all or nothing approach. And some of us erred more towards the side of nothing than all.
Well, part of it has to do
with... I still have nightmares about that second test.
Part of it has to do with the software program that the university, that the dental school is using for giving these exams. And it's somewhat limited in terms of how you can grade short answers. And
right.
We, like Dr. Rosebush was saying, we like to be able to pull up all of question one and grade it all at once. And this software program has no option to do that. So I can't pull up 75 answers to question one and grade them all at the same time. I have to go in individually and open each person's test and then also find the question because they're shuffled and for each person. And so it's just incredibly frustrating. So could we do it? Conceivably, yes. But the grading would take much longer, and we would want to shave our heads after having to grade a test like that. So... You know, thankfully, as you know, for second year PATH, we have been able to, using appropriate social distancing in two different classrooms and rolling arrival and departure times, we've been able to have you all come in and take the paper test that we like to give. And that has been wonderful.
Yeah.
So we would much rather have you in class also. Mm-hmm. So.
All right. And hopefully we'll get back there.
All impressed. I think we were all impressed just with, like, how y'all were able to do the written test, like, how organized it was and how we were all split up, and just, like, the instructions y'all gave.
Yeah, and even then we were like, don't come early. You better not come early. You'll screw up.
We were scared to death to show up, like, 1 minute early.
Yeah, no, we did end up letting a few people in early, and I'm going to have to put out some hard rules for the next time because I don't want the whole class showing up early and screwing it up. Yeah. So, yeah, it was definitely, we didn't know how it was going to go, and we didn't know if we were going to be able to do it again, depending on if you all followed the rules or not. Because believe it or not, not everybody always listens or reads their email.
Well, I think it was funny because that day... someone had said that you guys had sent an email, and then there was like debate in the GroupMe as to what people thought you two were going to do on test day. And it's like, she just sent an email about it, and they're like, no, man, I think she's going to do this. And it's like, no, like word for word, she sent an email. And he's like,
right here.
Yeah, like,
what would we do?
I don't know, but surprise. People ended up having to take screenshots and then highlighting what you said,
gosh.
And then sent that in the group, and it's like, dude, just open your email. It goes, oh, sorry, I don't check my email very often.
See, now that's the thing with technology that I think that you all, you know, have to take greater responsibility for, and maybe you two are good about it, but some people do, they say that, I'm going to check my email, and it's like, come on, you know, it is 2020, and you're in a professional school, you need to be regularly checking your email. I don't buy this,
exactly.
I don't check my email.
Exactly.
Right, it was just funny, because it was four or five people that were straight up having a debate as to what they thought test day was going to look like and what they thought the format was going to be, and it's like, no, we got
literally
more info in that one email than we do from most of our other professors.
Yes, ever.
But I think this whole discussion speaks to how much more logistically involved teaching is right now.
Yes.
You know, I mean, just between just creating Zoom links, posting, you know, recordings, and all of that. So,
yeah.
So I guess one of our last questions here is, oral pathology aside, what advice would you give to current dental students across the country, not just at LSU?
About?
Just life in general, or getting through dental school, or what life looks like after dental school?
Check your email.
I think finding something that you enjoy and realizing that you don't have to make a decision while you're in dental school about what you want to do with your whole professional career. that, you know, you feel this intense pressure to decide right now, do I want to specialize or do I want to practice general dentistry? And, you know, now that I'm 47, and, you know, I felt that pressure as well. And looking back on it, you know, I could have probably gone and practiced general dentistry for, you know, a couple of years and really found what I really loved. And thankfully, this worked out well for me. But I didn't know if it was going to be the right choice at that time. And some people know, like hardcore know what they want to do. But a lot of people, they may have interest in a variety of different things. And give yourself time and realize that you can always apply to a specialty later. And specialties like people who have some experience out in practice and who have matured a little more. And the likelihood of getting in when you have that additional experience under your belt, even if you don't necessarily have the highest GPA, that's going to give you an added leg up compared to perhaps the 4.0 dental student applying right out of dental school. And that life is going to, you know, gradually pass, and you don't have to make all your decisions by the time you're at the end of your fourth year of dental school. That's what I would say. My brother, who is a non-traditional dental student, went back after working in business for 20 years, came to dental school when he was about 40, and finished dental school and has now gone on to specialize. That's so awesome. You know, he is the classic example of someone who you can always choose another path and your opportunities are there.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. I would say, you know, 2 points, like for people who are just beginning dental school, you know, I would say develop good study, figure out good study habits and manage your time, because that's, I think, where you can get really thrown off in dental school, is because you are in class, whether it's virtually or not, all the time. Like, that's a huge change from like undergrad, where you're just like, oh, maybe like a few hours each day, you know? And so don't get behind, like stay on top of everything, you know? And then in terms of like more longer term, you know, career advice, you know, I agree with Dr. Cordell. Like I love oral pathology, and everything has worked out like beautifully for me. So I have no regrets, you know, but I sometimes wonder, like, would I do this over again if I like had to like rewind everything? Like, I don't know. Like, one of the big drawbacks to oral pathology is it's really difficult to practice anywhere you want, you know? So I never imagined myself living in either Memphis or New Orleans. You know, I've loved both places, but, you know, I would love to be closer to my family that's in Michigan. And so, you know, I think I would have been, you know, fine practicing general dentistry if I'd given it a chance. And I don't know, like when I see like some of my other like friends, I'm thinking ortho would have been a good idea too. So yeah, I think that's, you know, really good advice, that you don't have to have it figured out like right, you know, during your third year of dental school. And you know, it's like, do a GPR or an AGD, or, you know, go practice for a while. And then, you know, there are people who say like, oh, once you start practicing and making money, you're not going to want to go back to school. Like, I don't believe that. I think if you are really passionate about a specialty, like you'll go back and do it.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's really awesome. And it's cool because I think our class is starting to have some of those conversations of, hey man, like, where do you think you're going to live after dental school, or right, what's your plan? And, you know, we have some people that are going to move far, far away, mm-hmm, as of right now, and some people that are dead set on specializing. And
yeah,
I think it'll be interesting to see even now, like, how that'll change within the next year or two.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, life changes. I mean, think about Dylan Roberts. A year, yeah, ago, he had a full head of hair and was 40 pounds heavier, and now he is bald, has lost 40 pounds, and he has a baby on the way.
I was going to ask him, like, what's he
going to
say about
that? Yeah, he did the keto diet and lost a ton of weight on it. Okay. We talk about him pretty frequently on the podcast. But yeah, now him and his wife have a baby on the way.
Very exciting. That's great.
I'm not going to say his baby's name on the podcast, but very sweet. And so, Clayton, what's our last thing here? What do we usually end off with?
So we like to end it on this question. So what is, like, a wild or funny story that one or both of you have just in your practice or being at LSU or anything like that?
Well, I one time saw a patient with a dental student that they had taken pictures and they were concerned that she had an oral cancer in the floor of her mouth. And it turned out what was happening was she had teeth that she was taking in and out of her mouth, her own teeth that she had lost. And she was taking them in and out of what was left of their sockets on a nightly basis. She would take them out and then put them back in the morning. And she had a partial that fit onto this area. And it was a pretty dramatic, pretty crazy presentation and figuring this out. And, you know, it was kind of like, that's not what you're supposed to do with your teeth. That's just one story that was, you know, kind of recent. But there's all kinds of other stories along those lines.
I mean, the truth is really, like, stranger than, you know, whatever you could make up sometimes in this profession. And we are never surprised, like, you know, by anything. And I think I showed you guys the radiograph in class of the guy that put the wood screws in his roots so that he could, like, reestablish his occlusal tape. That was a guy from Arkansas.
Not surprising. Not surprising.
And people just do what they think that, you know, they can do at home and they think it's okay. I had another patient who had a tooth fracture off and reattached it with super glue in his mouth, you know, to the root that was still there, visible. And, you know, you can't fathom thinking about doing some of these things just because of your education level. And you have to keep your mind open that people are going to do all kinds of different things. And you never want to judge them. You always want to, you know, just give them proper education about what they should or shouldn't be doing with their teeth. So, and then, of course, the person who lets something grow, you know, to a very large size is always just, you know, mind-boggling. So,
yeah, it always amazes me the pictures that y'all show and just, like, how people just let these things grow in their mouths and never get it checked on. I don't know.
I think a lot of that is fear. You know, people are afraid of cancer.
Absolutely.
And rather than, like, getting that diagnosis that something could be cancer, they're just like, I'll just keep ignoring it.
Yeah. And then I think if it's not painful, you know, at least from the outset, they think that, like, oh, it probably isn't anything serious if I'm not having any pain. And that's another bad, you know, misconception, especially with, like, early oral cancer.
That's kind of how Marco and I are with tests. You know, if we just ignore it, it's not hurting us now. So,
I would say that's you more than me. You start studying 2 days before a test if the test is lucky.
I'm going to have to go back and reevaluate your test scores, Clayton.
It's fine. It's all fine.
That goes back
fine.
To the study techniques, you know, do what works for you. Like, I'm more like,
and see, that's my thing. Like, I have tried so hard to study, like, you know, a week or two in advance.
That's a lie.
I can't do it. It's just, I can't. Hey, you have to remember that I've been in school for like 35 years or something, so.
You have indeed, yeah. Clayton's actually about 70 years old. He's known as the old man.
Okay,
all
right.
But hey, he found the way that works for him.
That's right.
So, Clayton, you got anything else for us?
No, I don't think so. Thank you all so much for being on here. Y'all have given some great advice and just some great insight. I think it's been awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much.
It's been a lot of fun.
Glad to be here.
So anyways, this has been your host, Marco.
And this has been yours, Clayton.
And you've been listening to the
Pre-Dental
Podcast. All right, there we go. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Okay, guys, huge surprise. We have a second winner for the PAT Crusher subscription. Who is it, Marco?
Her name is Kathleen Sentato, and she goes to the University of Florida, where she is studying psychology and pre-dental. So congratulations, Kathleen. Be sure to DM us to get that prize.